Get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, lots of news. Most important, perhaps, being what the central banks are doing this past week. We are at a juncture in the U.S. and global economies, and I believe that's why Trump has changed his mind and wants to deal with Xi here on the trade thing. We'll see that next week. Next week, the big news, of course, will be the G20 meeting and the special meeting between Trump and Chinese President Xi on this trade war situation. The fact that the U.S. economy now is slowing dramatically, folks, right under our noses, is why the Fed has made this about turn and signaled that there's going to be a rate cut very soon, probably in July. And some on the Fed committee, called the Open Market Committee, have been talking about as much as 0.5% rate cut. And there were some disagreements. Some wanted a rate cut already. Well, the Fed decision meeting this past week comes right on the heels a day or so after a similar decision made by the European Central Bank and its chair there, Mario Draghi, which kind of put the pressure on the Fed, even got a response from Trump. And what was that? Well, the ECB, the Central Bank of Europe, came out and said it's going to lower rates. And it is not going to sell off its quantitative easing, I think $3 trillion of debt, of QE. QE is where the Fed buys up, pushes more money into the economy by buying up bonds. And in Europe, of course, they're not just buying government bonds, they're buying corporate bonds. And that's going to continue. They previously were talking, well, we might suspend that and start selling some of that off, like the Fed has done at $20 billion a month, token $20 billion. When it has over $4 trillion, figure it out, $20 billion a month. How long is it going to take the Federal Reserve to sell off its balance sheet? Well, the balance sheet sell-off is going to stop very soon. They may even start adding it once we have a recession. Talk about the U.S. as well as the Central Bank of Europe. Well, the ECB, earlier in the week, before the Fed meeting, said it was going to lower rates. In other words, provide more monetary stimulus. And before that, it had indicated it was going to add more to its bailout fund called the TLTRO, long-term refinancing operation. In other words, it's bailing out the banks in Europe even before the bank crash has come. And some banks in Europe are in very bad shape. You know, read the business press, Deutsche Bank, investment bank over there, a real basket case, but not just Deutsche Bank. You've got the Italian banks. You know, you got some French and Austrian banks. They're all in trouble. Despite the fact that now since 2009, the European Central Bank has pumped trillions of dollars into the banking system over there, and not much has happened. Certainly, they didn't get a recovery of economic growth with all the free money. And now, they've got no ammunition left in Europe. Very little ammunition, central bank here. Ammunition in the sense of lowering rates, you see. Why? Because Government bond rates are already negative and have been for a long time in Europe now and in Japan. Negative rates. $12.5 trillion of negative interest rates already. And the crisis is just beginning. Europe is the sick man of the global economy, the global capitalist economy. And you're going to see the failures in the next crisis may become first and certainly be more serious in Europe this time than in the U.S. Europe's a basket case economically, both in the real side and the financial side. Never really recovered from the 2008-09 crash. In fact, it acted too slowly in 2008-09 and set the stage for a double-dip recession that was even worse than 2011-13 in Europe. That double-dip recession and the lack of a real recovery afterwards has meant Europe has been stagnating for almost a decade now. Very weak recovery for a couple years, you know, I mean like a GDP of 1% or something like that, you know, slipping back into stagnation and recession, double dip. You could even argue a triple dip here in 15-16. That stop-go after the crash of 2008-09 is what I've always called an epic recession. It's not a normal recession. It's not a depression yet. There's something in between. It's a hybrid. In my 2010 book called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, I describe that phenomenon of that kind of a business cycle contraction different than a normal recession and not yet a Great Depression. Well, you know, we've called that the Great Recession, and no one's really explained it qualitatively. You know, guys like Paul Krugman, you know, have said a Great Recession. Oh, not as bad as a depression, a little bit worse than a normal recession. Well, that's analysis by adverbs. In my 2010 book, I try to explain that. Say, well, this is a new phenomenon. Well, it's not really new. It's happened before, but not recently, not since World War II. Anyway, that's what you got in Europe. You got an epic recession, stagnation, short, shallow recoveries followed by retractions, recontractions. Not too deep, not too long. You know, you add it up, it's all stagnation for a decade. That's why you got all the political problems emerging in Europe. It's a response. In Britain, it's Brexit, right? And you see it in other places taking a nationalist turn, whether it's Orban in Hungary and Poland, or whether it's the attempt for Catalonia to secede from Spain, or it's the Yellow Vest in France. It's all part of the same phenomenon, a response. And of course, it's taken a right-wing character. They call it populism. It's not populism. Taking a right-wing character because the traditional center-left parties, the Social Democratic parties, have imploded. And now, of course, that includes the SPD in Germany imploding as well. Labor market imploded, you know, the Labor Party imploded in Britain. The Socialist Party imploded in France. It's gone for good. You know, Corbyn is trying to resurrect the Labor Party, getting a lot of resistance. You know, from the rich folks who have been manipulating it, trying to take back the Labour Party. It's a struggle. It's all over Europe. The left has collapsed and leaving a vacuum that only the right steps into, given the crisis, given the long-term crisis that we see. That's Europe. And the real side of the economy, we see on the verge, on the precipice, on the cusp of a recession throughout Europe. Italy's already in recession. That's why you've got Salvini and the Five Star Movement now threatening to leave the Eurozone because the Eurozone is created to benefit the Northern European banks. It's a monetary solution, a monetary system where the members of the Eurozone cannot engage in fiscal policy to stimulate their economy, nor can they engage in exchange rate policy, lower their currencies to stimulate their exports. That's prevented. You can't do either if you have a euro single currency, and if the monetary system is controlled by the ECB, which is a council of central banks dominated by Germany and its allies in Northern Europe. And then you can't spend more than 3.5% of GDP. So fiscal policy is limited, exchange rate policy is eliminated, and all you got is monetary policy controlled by German and Northern banks. That's the Eurozone. One reason why Britain wants to try to get out of that. It's hamstrung. So, you have no solution to the coming crisis in Europe. You know, no policy solution. Fiscal monetary policy is dead or locked up. And that's why Italy's talking about, well, let's move out of this, you know. And that's why Britain says Brexit. I wrote a book a couple years ago when the focus was on little Greece, you know, a little appendage to the Eurozone, where they wanted to do the same thing. And, of course, they got crushed by the pan-European alliance there with the European Commission, ECB, right? They crushed it. And the Social Democratic Party at the time that was trying to reform it, called Syriza, collapsed and threw in its lot, and its leadership became just an appendage. And they're having elections there later in the year, and they're going to throw Syriza out. Problem is, there's nothing much on the left to take its place, so they'll move to the right again. They'll get New Democracy, which is just the guys who put them in the mess. Well, that's Europe. And that's how you need to see the economic underpinnings of the crisis going on, the nationalism going on in Europe. And it's just beginning. It's just beginning because now the economy is going to get much, much worse. And if Brexit leaves, that's even going to exacerbate. If Brexit occurs and Britain leaves, which it looks like it is, because now you got Boris Johnson, who's going to be the next prime minister, and he is on the record vociferously for Brexit. So hard Brexit is probably going to happen unless the Europeans soften up their position on the terms for them leaving. But they can't do that without encouraging a dissembling, an entropy of the entire European Eurozone single currency experiment. You know, Italy just about on the verge of leaving. It'll happen. So, you know, the European Commission, the Continentals there, they have a very difficult time of giving any better deal to the Brits to leave, because they'll just stir their hornet's nest at home. And the deal for the Brits is terrible. And they wanted them to pay something like $40 billion or more just to leave. Yeah. And then the terms of leaving weren't very good at all. They were really going to be in it still for 18 more months. Anyway, Europe's a mess. It's a basket case. And now Germany, the real economy, has stagnated. Some signs of even declining. It'll be up and down a little bit here for the next few months. French economy is slowing in some ways. Italy, of course, as I said, is in a recession. I haven't been following the other countries, but, you know, they pretty much just follow the same path. Okay. So, Europe and the ECB signal it's going to have to liberalize. It's going to have to stimulate. Well, when it says that, right, it drives the euro down. Because Europe's heavily dependent on exports to the rest of the world. You see, Trump is screwing them. or this trade war, and Germany is especially dependent on exports. So the way you protect your share is to lower your currency. And, of course, the central bank does that. Individual countries can't do that because it's a single currency. So the central bank, ECB, signals it's going to stimulate. It's going to pump more money into the economy. You increase the supply of money, the price of money, the interest rate goes down. It's already negative. It's going to go further. And it has already gone further. Now, when that happens, all that free money flows in. And you know what happens next? Well, the financial markets boom. Because here comes the free money or the cheap money. We're just going to borrow that. And instead of investing in the real economy, we are going to invest it, that we borrow the cheap money, in financial asset markets. This is a big change in the global capitalist economy in recent decades. It's been financialized, meaning you have all these new financial asset markets that are linked technologically instantaneously, and you have a new class of investors who are now dominant, who take this money and move it around globally because it's more profitable to invest in financial assets. You can move your money quicker. And that's what's happening to capitalism. And there's a new finance capital elite that's been created. And they have their claws into the governments everywhere. So the policies remain beneficial to them. And that's why you see when interest rates are gone down or not even gone down, just saying they're going to go down, boom, there goes the financial markets. There goes the stock and bond markets and other asset markets. Well, isn't that just what's happened in the U.S.? Last year, the Fed tried to raise interest rates, raised it four times. The rates only got up to 2.4%, and it precipitated a crash almost, a near crash in the stock market. A near crash. That was last October, December. And when Trump and the capitalists leaned on the Federal Reserve and said, stop raising rates, well, then the markets recovered right away. Not totally, only about two-thirds here in the first 3 months of this year of what the loss was last December, October, December. Yeah, they recovered simply by saying we're not going to raise anymore. You know, Trump was threatening to fire Fed Chair Powell, and he caved in. Powell caved in, capitulated, and in early January, he said, okay, we're going to adopt a policy of patience, they call it, patience, meaning we're not going to raise rates. And the markets recovered. Well, what happened this past week is that Fed Chair Powell said, we're going to start cutting rates. Well, that was a signal for the markets to enter even a higher level of bubble, which they've done. In just 1 week, we got a bubble, the peak bubble going on now, the next leg of the bubble in stocks and bond markets, U.S. and globally, because all the rest follow the U.S. Yeah, we got a big bubble boost going on, which is always, you know, the preview to an eventual crash. Just the announcement that we may raise rates, and of course they are, because both the Fed and the ECB have seen what's happening in the last month to the real economy. It is softening very fast, all of a sudden. They see this. Well, we've talked about Europe stagnant or declining in key economies there. What about the U.S.? What's happening under the covers in the U.S.? Well, it's pretty much stalled. The U.S. economy has stalled in recent weeks. What's called the PMI, Purchasing Managers Index. There's an index for manufacturing, and there's an index for the service sectors. Well, the manufacturing index is now down to 50.1. If it's below 50, it's contracting. Above 50, it's growing. Well, 50.1 statistically insignificant. It's flat. It's stagnant. It's not moving. If it stays at 50.1 or 50, manufacturing is dead in the water. No growth. Well, what about services? Services are 80% of the economy now in the U.S. Well, that's declined precipitously as well. It's only at 50.7, the lowest in 3.5 years. The services PMI. So in other words, the U.S. economy is virtually flat in the water in the last month. And if that continues, which is likely it will, then we're going to see a significant cut in the Fed rates come July. And the markets know that, and they're booming. And it's not just the stock and bond markets, but you see also other financial asset markets booming as well, because all these financial assets are interchangeable, substitutable for each other. Gold is at a six-year high. Gold prices have shot up. Bitcoin, which is just a financial asset play, you know, like gold futures, that's up significantly. Oil futures are up. Oil is a financial asset. It's not just a commodity. And, of course, what's going on in Iran out there has boosted it even further. So all the asset markets are booming. Why? Because they know the money is coming. They know the money is coming and that there's going to be more borrowing by bankers and investors from the Fed with all the excess liquidity the Fed is about to further inject and the ECB into the economy. And by the way, you know, the Royal Bank of Australia has cut rates and others are cutting rates left and right everywhere. It's globally. It's happening globally. So what we got is the Fed and the ECB feeding the financial markets again. It's a feeding frenzy going on, and the bubbles are bubbling higher. And the real economy is flattening, about to contract. That's the picture. So we are at this kind of juncture right now in the U.S. and global economy. A very interesting, important time. And where is all this free money going? Well, as I said, it's going into financial assets. How is it getting there? Well, your corporations, your businesses are just distributing it in trillions to shareholders. And the shareholders are reinvesting it in financial markets. And so are the institutions themselves, corporations and so forth. Well, as I've said before on this show, last year, $1.3 trillion distributed just by the Fortune 500 companies to their shareholders in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. $1.3 trillion. And it's running at a $1.4 trillion rate this year. Well, that's also directly attributable to the Trump tax cuts. They get to keep more of their money, you see. Corporations get to keep more. Investors get to keep more. That's the essence of the Trump tax cuts. And if they get to keep more, they plow it back in to financial markets because that's where the big profits are. And that's going on increasingly. And that's why you got so much income inequality. It's capital incomes. It's financial investment and speculation driving up this $1.3 trillion distribution to shareholders. The capital incomes are running away from all the other incomes, wage incomes, earned incomes. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. All right. You know, on this show and on my blog, jackrasmus.com, I am not reticent about criticizing official government data. And, of course, this has provoked some response by, quote, people on the center left who have friends in the government, and they don't like that kind of criticism. But let's revisit a little bit of this in recent this past week. You know, when it comes to data reliability, economic data reliability, I've been addressing GDP, jobs, wages, prices, and so forth, right? And I've said from time to time that GDP is being manipulated, not just in the U.S., by redefining categories. There's lots of ways to manipulate GDP. And not just in the U.S., but globally. You know, in Europe and in the oil-producing countries in particular, Nigeria and others, you know, they just redefine their categories give themselves a boost in GDP. Well, India in recent years has been a real violator of that. India, I figure 2 or 3 years ago, doubled its GDP by redefining. Now, I've got acquaintances who are Indian investors, and they say, well, you know, we just take India's official number and cut it in half. Well, this past week, one of the insiders who has left that bureaucracy revealed, you know, the tricks of the trade and showed that the India GDP is really about half of what they're reporting. They're reporting like 6%, something like that, right? Supposed to be the fastest growing economy now, even faster than China. Well, China manipulates its GDP too. They all do. I'm not saying it's a, you know, outright falsification. You can play these games with statistics. You know, you change the assumptions, you change the definition, you add extraneous data, you eliminate certain data. You can come up, you know, you can tweak the numbers quite a bit. Okay, that's GDP. Here's another one that I found interesting. Jobs. As you know, I've been critiquing the U.S. job figures. In my view, there's a lot of second and third jobs being added to the economy, in the service sectors in particularly. As far as the government is concerned, a part-time job is an employment, right? That affects the unemployment rate and so forth. There's a lot of second and third jobs being created. But if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, well, second jobs are not changing that much, the number of second jobs. So something must be wrong. You know, either BLS is right or my suspicion is right. Well, there was a survey came out this past week, Bankrate, you know, respected research bank research source, a Bankrate survey. Go check it out. Right? That showed that 48% of millennials now have second and third jobs. 48%. 39% of Gen X, in other words, those who came right before the millennials, have second and third jobs. And 28% of the boomers have second and third jobs. 45% of all U.S. workers are working second jobs. 45%. For millennials, the 48% or half of millennials have second jobs, right? It makes up half of their pay, which means they're not making that much, right? If their second job is half of their pay. Okay, so Bankrate survey suggests there's a lot more people working second and third jobs. Now, this is where the data becomes suspect. In 2017, the pay, the monthly pay for people working second jobs, part-time jobs, monthly pay was $686 a month. Part-time jobs, $686 a month. Okay. Now, last year, that jumped from $686 a month to $1,122 a month in 2018, a 69% increase in the pay for part-time work. Now, do you all get a 69% raise in your part-time job? I don't think so. If you didn't get a 69% raise, it must mean that more part-time jobs are being added, so the total goes up to 1,122. The total pay from part-time work went from 686 to 1,122 in 1 year. I interpret that as meaning people are working second and third jobs more. More people working second and third jobs. Either part-time jobs resulted in 69% pay raise last year, or the number of part-time jobs increased dramatically, one or the other. And if that latter is true, then the government data about virtually no increase in part-time second jobs is inaccurate. There's been a significant increase in part-time second, third jobs, I believe. And that showed up in the job creation numbers in the BLS job survey. Right? And if you look at the BLS data, the number of full-time jobs have actually declined. They've been declining full-time jobs. What this means is that a lot of employers are getting rid of full-time workers and hiring part-time workers. Why? Because they don't have to pay benefits for part-time workers. They don't have to pay health care. They don't have to pay pensions or anything like that. Plus, it's more flexible for them, you see. With part-timers, they can jerk people around their work schedules and so forth. You know. So what we've got is more second and third jobs, I believe. And this affects the wages here, right? The government says that average hourly earnings increased 3.2% last year. Now, when you say earnings, right, what you're talking about is your hourly wage times the number of hours that you work. And if part-time jobs have been going up, right, then the hours go up, right? And the hours are really behind the 3.2%. It's not the wage rate, it's the number of hours. And keep in mind, as I've said before, this 3.2% is an average. It's an average, so that those at the top might be given more than 3.2%, the top 10% of the labor, hourly labor force, right? Those in the middle may not be getting anything. Those at below may be getting far, far less. And also that 3.2% is for full-time workers only. And it's not really adjusted for inflation. Now, here's another survey you might want to look at, PayScale. Go to payscale.com/payscale index. They've adjusted 3.2% for inflation and cost of living. And they found that last year, that earnings, wages earned as earnings, have actually shrunk by 0.8%. Didn't go up 3.2%. They shrunk. And there's been a 9% decline since 2006. And again, that's only an average, right? Those at the middle level and below are doing much worse than losing almost 10% of their income, their real income, spendable income, right? Look, we got to start looking harder at some of this government data, whether it's jobs data, wage data. Let's not just accept the assumptions and think the data collection is done correctly. The definitions of these categories need to be looked at. All right, so that's my my contribution to this debate on the data. Let's move to another topic, Facebook. Right? I recently gave a TV interview here. It's on my blog, jackrasmus.com, about Facebook leaping into the digital token payment system with its new Libra, it's called, digital token, right? Libra, competitor to Bitcoin, maybe, right? Well, for Facebook, this isn't really a Bitcoin play. In other words, I'm going to issue Bitcoin because Bitcoin is just a speculative play, basically. Right? It's like gold futures contracts, right? Bitcoin's been going up. Well, maybe investors in cryptocurrencies, which Bitcoin is one and Libra is now another, knew the Libra was coming, and they started buying up Bitcoin. Because it certainly, Facebook and Libra certainly legitimizes the cryptocurrency phenomenon in market even further. Maybe they knew that, so they, you know, maybe even Facebook people started speculating in Bitcoin. I wouldn't doubt that. Okay. Well, both Libra and Bitcoin are based upon a technology called blockchain, a digital token technology. And it's blockchain is really started out as a way of a new kind of global payments system. You see, the way the payment system is today with all these different currencies, the currencies have to be exchanged from one currency into the other currency. You know, if I'm an Argentine investor and I want to buy treasury bonds, I got to take my Argentine peso, I got to go to an international currency market, I got to exchange my peso for dollars before I can buy U.S. bonds, right? Exchange rates, they call them. And, of course, whoever does the exchanging charges a fee, a nice fee. You ever go to the airport and exchange your money for something else, other currency? Yeah, you know you get ripped off, right? Well, retailers get, customers get ripped off more than business customers, but you still got to pay a fee as a business customer if you want to move your money from one currency to another. Well, the whole idea of digital tokens and blockchain is to eliminate that slow process. And costly process that is now dominated by the banks. The banking, commercial banking system, right? They got a nice monopoly on that. Well, digital tokens is really a way of bypassing that. And that's what Facebook's trying to do. It's entering what's called the fintech, financial tech industry now, and partnering with the credit card companies and a bunch of other companies to create its own private payment system, bypassing the established payment system, which is not based upon digital tokens, but based upon currencies issued by the central banks. Mostly the dollar, you see, because 85% of all trade is done with dollars in the world. So if you want to move your money around and buy something, you got to trade it in for dollars, right? Well, what's in this for Facebook? Well, it's a new product line for Facebook. Facebook is becoming what we call a shadow bank. In other words, technology developing these new kinds of financial institutions, which are outside the regulatory orbit of the central banks. That's what shadow banks are, you see. And it was the shadow banks that gave us the last crisis, you see, because if you're outside the regulatory orbit, you can take big risks, right? And extend and, well, you know, that's what Lehman Brothers was, investment bank, it's a shadow bank, a Bear Stearns shadow bank, right? These are all financial institutions now that control more assets, investable assets, than the commercial banking system, you know, the Morgans and the Wells Fargo's and so forth. Yeah, they're that big. And they got their claws, as I said earlier, into government. You know, Goldman Sachs. Shadow bank, right? Running much of the U.S. government, economic policy, certainly financial policy. You know, that's where Mnuchin comes from. That's where Gary Cohn, advisor to Trump till he left, comes from. That's where the head of the Federal Reserve, New York, came from. And governors in the East, New Jersey, elsewhere, right? Goldman Sachs. Big contributor to campaigns of leading politicians on both sides, Republican and Democrat. Okay. So, you know, this blockchain lowers the cost of transactions. But they still charge a fee. You know, they'll still make some money off of this. But it's a competition, you see. It poses a competition with the commercial banking system and the central banks. And it's really creating money, you see. And they central banks don't like that. And the bank, private banks don't like that. They want to be the money creators, the fiat money creators. This is a challenge. You know, and the Federal Reserve and central banks are already losing control of the money supply because of globalization and other technology reasons. You know, this independent payment system is a real challenge to them. They're not going to let it happen. Already we see a fast regulatory response. Well, why would Facebook, already facing regulatory pressures for its privacy violations, you know, and the hacking that occurs of Facebook, why would it go into a new product line that portends even more regulatory oversight? Well, because there's big money for them, and it enables Facebook to leverage its existing product line, particularly in developing markets. It's a way it will grow more customers, users in emerging markets. And that's where the growth is for them. Plus, there's plans to add, I'm sure, new financial services on top of this. You may be buying your home from Facebook a decade from now. Well, Amazon's getting into finance, too. They're all getting into it, right? And in a way, you know, Facebook has to get into it because already a Chinese company, Tencent and Telegraph, they're already doing this payment system. That under, you know, an independent payment system also undermines a very important financial lever of U.S. economic empire, you know, which is the SWIFT system. SWIFT payment system that the U.S. uses. Well, it's using it quite effectively against Venezuela now, right? So expect more regulatory and oversight, and expect more hacking. You know, the hackers get into Facebook and get your personal data. Now they'll be able to hack and get all your financial data, your credit card numbers and all that. Yeah, oh, well, you know, Facebook's saying, well, you know, we're setting up a separate company, Calibri, to do this. And really, this is an association that's located in Switzerland. Yeah, opaque Switzerland that doesn't like to share data on its finances of foreigners. Okay. If you want more about shadow banks, my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, had an entire chapter on the shadow banking system and its responsibility in shifting global real investment towards financial investment and the consequences of that for financial bubbles and instability in the global economy. Okay, that's Facebook. In the past, I've talked a lot about profits repatriation and the Trump tax cuts. Remember that? We talk about, I spelled out how the Trump tax cuts are really $4.5 trillion because $2 trillion will accrue just to the multinational corporations as a result of eliminating the foreign profits tax and eliminating all what's called territorial taxes. In other words, not taxing U.S. multinationals that move offshore and make money offshore. Right? Before, officially, they had to pay 35% tax rate, corporate income tax rate. I'm talking about U.S. multinationals offshore, and they've really gone offshore since Reagan. Yeah, but they got out of having to pay the 35% because Bill Clinton allowed them to check a box, which simply said their foreign earnings were not taxable. Check a box under tax returns. It was actually called that, check a box. Check box. All right, so in the Trump tax cuts, what they've done is a one-time repatriation. If you bring your money back that you've been hoarding offshore, and the Fortune 500 alone hoarded $4 trillion offshore. I'm not talking about all the other thousands of American companies. Instead of paying a 35% tax rate, bringing the money back, you could pay roughly a 10% or less tax rate. by bringing the money back. Repatriate it. Pay 10%, right, of the $4 trillion. And then for future earnings, you virtually, in 2019 and beyond, you virtually pay no taxes on your foreign earnings. There's a little token here and there, but virtually they'll pay nothing, which is just an incentive for them to move more jobs offshore. There's a contradiction between Trump's tax cuts and his trade policy, right? He talks about trade policy, oh, bring the jobs back. Well, at the same time, his tax policy gives them incentive to move and keep the jobs offshore because they don't pay taxes on offshore earnings. Well, how much have they brought back here? You know, the first year, bring back 1 year of repatriation, 10%. After that, future profits, almost nil. Okay, so how much have they brought back? Well, we got data now. Read the Wall Street Journal today, June 21st, page 4. Right? The first report that I've seen of how much they brought back in last year, they brought back $776 billion. Right? So they had $4 trillion, and they bring him back almost a fourth of that. And then the first quarter of this year, another $100 billion. So $876 billion has been repatriated, paying a tax rate of 10% instead of 35%. Well, you know, that means they save 25% on their tax, on their corporate income tax, which is, you know, a nice bit of money. Instead of paying 35%, right, they pay only 10%. And what does that mean? Well, a 35% rate on $876 billion compared to a 10% rate on it is a differential of about $80 billion. They only paid $80 billion. You know, they were supposed to pay $300 billion maybe, but they only paid $80 billion. So they saved $219 billion last year alone. The Fortune 500 multinational corporations saved $219 billion in reduced taxation last year alone. They only paid $80 billion on that nearly $1 trillion, which is, you know, about 10%. Ah, but don't forget, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a notification that the U.S., for a handful of companies, you know, maybe a couple dozen, wrote checks for $79 billion. In other words, gave them a subsidy of $79 billion, including Amazon, multi-billion dollar profit company, you know, several of the big banks, Boeing, a bunch of others, oil companies, $79 billion check. You know, that's your tax money you paid. They turned it around and redistributed $79 billion to profitable companies. Well, that kind of offsets, doesn't it, the $80 billion that they're paying for bringing this nearly $1 trillion back. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, these numbers, because we're only talking about the Fortune 500 companies here. What did they do with the rest of this $776 or $800 billion that they brought back? Well, it's pretty clear that it's gone into stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That's what's driving, you know, this $1 trillion plus buybacks and dividend payouts. They gave it to shareholders instead of investing it and expanding the real economy in the U.S. That's the connection between the tax cuts and the stock buybacks. All right, so another item in the news is the Pentagon. And Congress, right? We just seen here this week as well a new budget, $983 billion proposed by Congress, spending bill. $733 billion is the Pentagon budget. Trump wanted $750. Well, the Democrats can give him $733. That's pretty good. Getting most of what he wants. Yeah, because he'll probably steal the difference to build his wall. Right? Okay. What we got going here under the Democrats and Trump for the last couple years is the Democrats are willing to increase the defense more spending in exchange for maintaining the social spending programs without cuts. So you get a couple hundred billion in social spending and you get 733 in defense spending. But wait, that's not military spending. 733 billion, that's only for the Pentagon. That's not military spending. That's a subset. Pentagon spending is a subset. Well, where does the rest come and how much does it all add up to? Well, that $733 billion does not include what's called OCO expenditures, Overseas Contingency Operations, OCO. In other words, direct war spending. Like in Afghanistan, that's still going on, direct war spending. That's not in the Pentagon budget. That's an additional amount. What's going on in Iran, you know, sending 1,000 troops and who knows how much else of everything. That's probably OCO. They're probably going to draw on OCO as they build up in the Baltics and Poland. This is OCO spending is in addition to Pentagon spending of $733 billion. Who knows what that's going to be? Then there's what's called the black off budget. This is secret weapons programs development. A decade ago was estimated by people who were on the inside and came out somewhere between $50 and $70 billion a year on super secret next generation weapons. That's undoubtedly higher because they're spending a lot more on cybersecurity now. Only the big corporations, defense corporations, and select leaders in Congress, you know, leaders of both parties, and heads of the defense committees, appropriation committees, you know, just a handful, maybe a dozen or so people know about this black off budget. That spending does not show up in print anywhere in the annual budget. So you got to add that 50, 70, maybe even more billion and possible OCO spending to the 733 Pentagon spending, but that's not all because the spending by the U.S. military on oil and fuel is not in the Pentagon budget. It's in the Energy Department budget. Ditto for the spending on next-generation tactical nuclear weapons. That's the Atomic Energy budget. And then we have Veterans Administration, pensions, the generals and officers and so forth, and health care for all the vets. That's not in the Pentagon budget, that's in the Veterans Administration budget. And then we have housing, spending on housing, subsidizing housing for vets, education, job retraining, right? That's not there, that's in those departments. And what about the NSA, the CIA, and the State Department? We all know that they're running their own mercenary special ops. Private special ops, mercenary forces, and that's growing significantly. NSA, CIA, even State Department. How much is that? Well, that's in their budget. Homeland Security, part of Homeland Security should be considered defense budget. Okay, so you add all these up, we're easily at $1 trillion a year in, quote, defense, unquote, spending, easily. Trillion a year. And that trillion has what economists call very low multiplier effects. In other words, it doesn't impact the economy that much. You know, in the equipment spending, which is going up as a higher share of Pentagon spending, you know, on aircraft and stuff like that, jets and that, et cetera. Well, you know, a lot of that production is offshored to get the Japanese and the Koreans and the Europeans to buy the F-35 and so forth. They give them a piece of the action, you know, assembly this, assembly that. Doesn't generate the jobs that it used to. Okay. Now, the Fed gave a press conference this past week, returning to that topic, and it was interesting to listen to Chairman Powell. And having just listened a day or two before to ECB Chairman Mario Draghi, these guys are worried. All of a sudden, they know something is happening, and they're increasingly worried. Instead of emphasizing patience in terms of rate cuts, as Powell had since January, now the key concept is cross-currents. Cross-currents. In other words, re-emerging problems and softness, re-emerging fast. And that's what he talked about. Business investment has stalled in the second quarter. We showed how manufacturing has also stalled. According to Powell, consumption is still okay, but business spending and business confidence and business investment has stalled. Trade, of course, is a big question mark, especially globally. The global economy is slowing very fast, and trade is behind it, or playing a big role in it. The trade conflicts, Trump trade conflicts here, starting to bite on the global economy big time, especially the other areas of the world economy much more dependent on exports and imports than the U.S. So a combination of manufacturing stalling and business investment stalling and trade wars and global growth and looking at what's happening in Europe, particularly now with Brexit, hard Brexit more likely coming, Powell said, well, we're going to have to watch this, right? These are cross currents, right? Negatives, in other words. And he says jobs and wages are looking okay. Well, as we've talked about, you look under the covers, jobs and wages are not okay. Well, last month we had only 75,000 jobs, even given the way jobs are overcounted, I think. He still thinks wages are rising. For the vast majority, I don't believe so. Right? He says there's a tight labor market. I don't believe the labor market is tight. And consumer spending has recovered, he says. Those are the positive data pieces. But the negative, of course, manufacturing, business, trade, global growth, trade wars, etc. So he's watching. And the markets are betting that what he's going to see as he watches is a further softening of all this. And some are talking about a half a percentage point rate cut in July should this whole trend continue at the level that it is, which it will. Right? I believe, too, this realization by Trump is sort of prodded him. He desperately wants a meeting with President Xi at the G20. It looked like Xi might not meet with him, but now he has. So, and a lot of happy talk coming out before the meeting here. So I think the likelihood of a deal, I've always said there will be a deal as the economies weaken. Question is, has the U.S. economy weakened enough that Trump wants a deal? Trump doesn't want a deal too soon either. He wants it, you know, well into the election cycle. Although, you know, on the other hand, if the economy weakens too much, it may get out of control, and better to have a deal now rather than later. But I think that's going to happen. If that happens, if a deal happens, the Chinese will have, I believe, successfully held off conceding, capitulating on the technology issue that the U.S. hardliners wanted to do. It'll be a deal where the U.S. will buy, where China will buy far more goods and allow the U.S. corporations a bigger share of the Chinese economy. That's what the deal will look like. But we'll see that next week with the G20 meeting.